Det är onsdagen den 19 april. Jag heter Andreas Eriksson och du lyssnar till Ledarredaktionen, en podd från Svenska Dagbladet. Varmt välkomna! Hoppas ni har det skönt i vårsolen. Idag har jag en alldeles särskild gäst i podden som jag ska tänka prata politik och journalistik med, och inte minst synen på Sverige utifrån. Han är på besök i Sverige för tillfället, ett land han har lärt känna under de senaste 20 åren och som han säger sig älska. I love Sweden, he told me yesterday. Han heter Fraser Nelson och är chefredaktör för den brittiska tidningen The Spectator. Fraser, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much.
Wonderful to have you here. How are you today?
I'm fine. I'm delighted to be back in Stockholm. The spring has started, and I think there's no more beautiful sight on God's earth than Sweden in early spring.
You're too kind. The Spectator, obviously a very well-known publication, but just for the one or two listeners that isn't all that familiar, could you please tell us a little about The Spectator, the short introduction?
We're the oldest weekly in the world. We're sometimes described as Britain's most influential magazine. We are, you know, smaller than most newspapers, although we now sell more than The Guardian. And we tend to be positioned on the right of the centre, but we're not particularly a political magazine. We're mainly here to write about politics, culture, books, arts, society in general. We now have got a website, so we're a daily publication. We've got podcasts, emails, even Spectator TV, and we've got a keen interest in the outside world. I personally am very interested in Sweden, which is why I'm here. Mm.
Could you compare The Spectator to Swedish Focus, perhaps, if you know it?
Yeah, I suppose that's the closest comparison, except to most of our subscribers, The Spectator is a daily publication. Mm-hmm. So 70% of our readers don't actually read anything in the magazine. They read the daily content. So we would like, if the story breaks at 9 o'clock, we would like to have analysis, good analysis, on our website by 11:30. Not even most newspapers can match that. So that's a strange combination of what we do. A magazine that which looks at the back of the week, but also a breaking views publication, one which does serve to give you the best analysis long before the newspapers get to the story.
Right. And what brings you to Stockholm this time?
I'm here on the trail of the mystery of gangland crime. I've been following Sweden. I'm married to a Swede, and I've been trying to divide my time between London and Stockholm for the last sort of 20 years. And there never ceases to be fascinating Swedish stories, but this is the most fascinating. I start most mornings by reading SVD, and the stories which you guys are coming out with now are just incredible. We've got children running around with guns. You've got a system where anybody under 15 is immune from prosecution. You've got the police say 1,200 children involved in criminal gangs, 50 gangs in Stockholm, a tiny city. What really struck me was actually listening to a speech by your Prime Minister in December, where he was saying that there are more people were killed by guns in Södertälje than the whole of London over a big chunk of last year. Mm. Now, I've been to Södertälje a few times. It's this beautiful little sleepy town. And how could it be that more people there were killed by guns than in the whole of London, which has got a population bigger than Stockholm? Mm. Now, there's only so much journalists can really understand by reading online publications, even ones as good as SVD. So I wanted to come here to talk to some of those involved, former police officers, social workers, the ones who are trying to grapple with this problem, to understand it and to try to get a little bit closer to why this incredible rich country is capable of breeding one of Europe's worst gang gun problems.
Mm. And just to underline what Fraser just said, that Södertälje is a town of fewer than 100,000 people, and London has more than 8 million. So yeah, it's quite astonishing. Have you started to solve this mystery? How far have you got so far?
I have got a little bit far. I shouldn't tell you who I spoke to because I'm not sure they want to be on or off the record yet. But I spoke to somebody who's working with children who've come over here unaccompanied for some years. Now he told me that there, in his view, The problem is what you guys call the opinion corridor. Mm-hmm. That when you start to talk about crime and ethnicity, Swedes get very uncomfortable. It's very difficult to really understand a problem if you can't analyze it. So now, if you go talk to most criminologists, and I've noticed this myself, they're always saying that we don't understand this. This is a mystery. But why don't they understand it? They're criminologists. Surely they should work it out. One of them I saw quoted recently is saying that we think it's linked to immigration. Well, obviously, it's linked to immigration. That's not enough. Now, the person I was talking to was saying, look, you need to really atomize this and find out, first of all, where are they from, these people? There's a difference between Afghans and Somalis. There's a difference between first generation and second generation. Now, superficially, you might link this emergence of crime to the wave of immigration that started in 2014. We all know that Sweden, the great humanitarian superpower, took in more people per capita than any other European country. Now, we also know that Sweden's got a pretty good reputation there. My wife herself is the daughter of refugees. They fled to Stockholm from the Soviets after the Prague Spring in 1968. Now, she is incredibly grateful to this country, which gave her penniless parents a job, a life, a society. She was taught her hemspråk at home, although she did think it was funny how the word hemspråk was used because her home is Sweden. Mm-hmm. So this nods to the integration problems that there are.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My point is that Sweden has always taken in lots of migrants, but it seems to have taken more than it could handle after 2014. And that was when you start to get more grenade bombings, which have now being supplanted by thermos flask bombings. But it seems, now this is one of the things that I've learned, that most of the people involved in the criminality here are second generation immigrants. So this is not somebody who's arrived from Somalia and decided instantly to go into crime. These are people who've been in Sweden since childhood, or even since they were born, who understand the system, who understand the police, who understand the vulnerabilities in the system, and do have the opportunity to do other things, but they're turning to organized crime. Now, why should that be? So I think this, of course, is hugely important. I mean, in the UK, we study ethnic data all the time. And that's so important because it means that you can go beyond the racial stereotypes. You learn very quickly when you look at this data. But the idea of a dichotomy between white and non-white is complete nonsense. In the UK, for example, we've got lots of ethnic groups that do better than the whites. You've got the Chinese, they do very good at school, very good economically. People of Indian background do way better than people from Pakistani, Bangladeshi background. Why is that? The whites are somewhere in the middle. People from Black African background do better from people from Black Caribbean background. Again, why is that? So you see that cultural values here start to play. This is not about skin color. To most white people, you could not really tell by looking at somebody, really, if they're Black African, Black Caribbean, or Bangladeshi or Indian. But there are other things going on. Now, if we're going to understand as a society why things are going wrong, we really need to atomize this and have a look at what's happening. In Sweden, for example, one of the things I've noticed anecdotally is that the Iranians seem to be doing a lot better than the Iraqis. Yeah. Now, why should that be? This is very interesting. But if you want to study this problem, you run out of resources pretty quickly in Sweden because there seems to be a certain taboo around delving too deeply around issues of race, culture, attainment, and criminality. So that is one of the things that I've noticed. Almost everybody I've spoken to, whether they're former policemen, social workers, even journalists, will say that there comes a point that if you talk about it too openly, you face some censure. You get accused of marching into Hitler's Germany. I've also noticed that the podcasts are a very good resource for learning about this. I'm not quite sure it's the there's the Crime Room podcast, of course, which Aftonbladet do. Then there is another podcast called The Last Supper, which I've been interested in. And I was fascinated. I never knew why it was called The Last Supper, but then I found out the other day, because initially those around the table were saying, were talking about these issues and saying, you know, if we said this openly, this would be our Last Supper, because it would create such a backlash.
Oh, right. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah. Because they were so far outside the opinion corridor, but they would be, they'd have their reputations assassinated. But then they thought, well, hang on a minute, if we don't do this, then we're leaving the conversation to the far right. We're ceding this massive territory to the populist extremist parties. Now, this is something of anybody who cares about immigration and integration. And Sweden now, as you can just look around and you can see, Sweden is now a melting pot country. It wasn't always this way, but it certainly is now, which means you have to take care of this and try to work out. And then also there seems to be this idea, and I think it might be a myth, that crime stems from poverty. Now, again, I was talking to this Finnish academic who studied this, and he's now in Oxford, and he's done a study into this, showing that there's a very weak link behind it. I also went yesterday to Rikkeby. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, but where, you know, again, when I read SVD, when I read the Swedish reports, Rikkeby features quite a lot in the reports where their police get called out to. And I wanted to see for myself what this area, which quite often is referred to as a ghetto, looks like. Mm-hmm. And I was warned by some of my Swedish friends, oh, be careful how you dress there, don't take out your phone, etc. Almost I was going into some kind of semi-war zone. It was delightful, absolutely delightful. It is easily better than anywhere I've lived up until the age of 35. And when I was talking to some young guys, I think they're from Somali background there, chatting to them, very good English. One of them was saying he went to the International English School locally. Now, IES is a fantastic school. I wish there was one near me in Twickenham. He wants to be an accountant. They were sure, there's no doubt the ethnic composition is very different to Merby, where my wife is from. But they were playing football on this all-weather purpose court. This reminded me more of Britain's private schools than of any kind of ghetto I've seen. And it seems to me as if whatever's going wrong here, it's pretty difficult to say, but this is linked to deprivation. I was even told by one of the local officials here that these kids are guaranteed a job by the council during summer. Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds to me incredibly generous. So why then are so many turning to crime? And I did find some answers towards that, but I should probably stop talking now.
Obviously, the Swedish discussion in recent year in media and politics has been a lot about immigration and crime. How do you perceive, from a British point of view, the average British people, has the view of Sweden changed in recent years, do you think, due to this news report?
Yes, absolutely. Sweden has always exerted this disproportionate force on the imagination of the outside world. Sweden more than any other Scandinavian country. Now, first of all, I remember 12 years ago, I was giving a speech to them at Engelsberg, to the Axel Johansson Foundation. They did this Images of Sweden project.
Yeah.
And looking back then, the images of Sweden then were the fact that I was talking about how Sweden had become a lodestar for left and right in Britain, how both the Conservatives and Labour looked to it for inspiration. So then it was the free school model, which the UK went on to imitate, or your pension reform, which was admiring it, or the Anders Borg's earned income tax credit system, which again the UK went on to imitate. So Swedes are very single-minded. You've got this incredible cultural self-confidence, this mystifying combination of individuality and obedience. Mm-hmm. And this always means there are things which exert fascination in the outside mind. So that's why, and there were books, there was a book, very good book called The Almost Perfect People, trying to look at the flaws in Scandinavian society. And then 10 years ago, you had the Nordic noir kind of genre of drama and books. Now, again, this juxtaposed the idea of bad things happening in kind of paradise. It was the juxtaposition which captured the imagination. And it's the same juxtaposition that captures the world's imagination now. So when the wave of immigration started in 2014, people were absolutely amazed at what was happening in Sweden. Amazed. You wouldn't think it'd be possible. Even me, I thought I knew Sweden reasonably well. I wouldn't think it'd be possible how there could be arson attacks in some of these hostels that were accommodating the underage migrants, that you could get these these new sort of crimes, which the Swedish authorities didn't seem to be able to handle. Now, as an editor, I know very quickly what interests my readers because we can see it in digital figures. There is a huge interest in anything, stories about things going wrong in Sweden. And that's because people find it hard to comprehend. How can it be that this rich society, which achieved all of these things, is battling all of these problems, which Britain would Britain would be horrified. A couple of years ago, there was a kid who was killed in Gothenburg because a grenade was thrown into his window. It was the wrong house. Now, if this had happened in Britain, it would have been front page news for days on end. But here it was another story. Mm-hmm. So all of the time, you're getting stories which are absolutely mind-blowingly staggering. We're getting a story about a recent 16-year-old who killed somebody in a gym recently and then was granted citizenship after the murder. While he was then eventually tracked down, he was taken to prison where he was given 2 years sentence. For unbelievable. Even that was too much for him. So he thought he'd do a jailbreak. So he books an appointment with a dentist. Apparently you can do that. And, you know,
yeah, this happened recently.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this is every single line of this is amazing to a British reader.
Because I know my co-worker, Paulina Neuding, has written in The Spectator about this several times, I think, hasn't she?
We've had the great pleasure of having Paulina, of having Tove Lindvall, of lots of SVD writers about this. I think that Tove is one of the most articulate experts on this. I always have to, the last time I had to beg her to write, she was so busy and said she's writing a book and couldn't. So I'd say to her, Paulina, there's nobody who can write this as well as you. Yeah. But every line of these stories, whether they're the small criminal stories or the bigger picture, is fascinating because we're trying to ask ourselves, well, the reason why I'm here right now, how is this possible? Is this happening in spite of Swedish openness or because of Swedish openness?
Let me ask you something about journalists, because yesterday I heard you made a presentation to the staff at Svenska Dagbladet, and you were talking about something that puzzled you about Swedish journalism, that we're not talking frankly enough about these issues when it comes to ethnicity of criminals. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
I would say that there are parameters of Swedish conversation, and this isn't so much about Swedish journalists. When you look at the political debates, etc., there still seems to be a territory, if you like, an opinion corridor, which is a bit wider for newspapers. But nonetheless, take journalists like Paulina, for example. She's been writing about this for some time and gets incredible abuse over the years for doing so. I can never quite understand that. Now, when you write about crime and ethnicity, again, this is relevant, but quite often these details are missing from the Swedish news reports. I was talking to a friend of mine who was saying, well, we all know that this is immigrant on immigrant kind of crime. And for a week, but we're not told that by the newspapers. Now, again, that's strange to me.
But you have an ethnic code that actually says, do not mention race or ethnicity when it's not necessary. It says so. So
yes. Now, my point, I don't for a second blame the Swedish journalists. Every journalist works within the parameters that were set, within what readers will find also acceptable. So it's to me, you know, that's, by the way, this is the first time I'd heard it. You've actually got a code which says, do not mention it. Right. Now, that is, I also... to me, that is just simply incomprehensible because, of course...
I don't think it says, don't mention it, but be careful before you mention it or something like that.
Be careful before you mention it. Well, any responsible journalist is careful not to use inflammatory language, but the rule of journalism is to try... Now, the problem is, of course, if you get attacked, it can be quite difficult. This is, by the way, for anybody speaking in public. This isn't just journalists, but anybody, you know, a social worker, a teacher, a policeman, a politician, the same kind of forces of censure seem to be there to those who stray too far from the opinion corridor. And I've also noticed your political debate has changed quite a lot over the years. It used to be the case that anybody mentioning this was seen to be, in league with the far right, etc. Now I think there seems to be more of a consensus between the main parties. But I still see that it seems to me that a Swedish journalist who does write frankly about the role that immigration, ethnicity, and culture has in these crimes is taking a risk, and it requires quite a lot of bravery to do that. That's not the case in the UK, where we always some people say, but that you know we've got a a dirty press conversation, but a kind of clean society. You know, you need somebody to go to explore properly all of these areas if you're going to make sure that you don't have a situation where you've got a gangland culture growing up simply because a failure to talk frankly about a problem will guarantee that problem is never solved and addressed. And I can understand why Sweden would not want to change your liberal... to me, the criminal justice system is jaw-droppingly liberal. The idea, for example, that you get 2 years for killing somebody if you're a 16-year-old hitman and that you can do a jailbreak by going to the dentist is just incomprehensible. In Britain, we once, we would imprison a 10-year-old for murder. We did once with the murder of Jamie Bulger. It doesn't happen very often. But there comes a point where you have to ask if the laws intended to protect children are actually making them more vulnerable to exploitation. Because if it's the case that the criminal censure facing a 14-year-old is negligible, then of course it's going to make more sense to use that 14-year-old to get them to do crime. If a 15, 16, 17-year-old is going to face small sentences, then that changes the incentive structure. I was watching SVT, a report recently about these two women who were saying that they were joining the gang culture as well. And they, if they put on clothes and they looked respectable, then nobody would suspect them. And they were blacked out. And then it cut to some experts saying, well, the problem is, how can we help these women? Now, that to me seems a very Swedish conversation. They are setting out to break the law. They've got a choice. Nobody's forcing them into crime. They're choosing it. Now, the question is how you help society by putting these sort of women in prison. If they get involved, you know, if you're caught in possession with a loaded gun, you know, that is a very big deal. You should go to prison for quite some time for deterrence. Now, that has always been the British way of seeing things. And I speak throughout all of this with the humility of an outsider. I'm just saying how it looks to British eyes.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
One more question about journalism. As I mentioned earlier, you made a brief presentation to our staff. And one thing that caught my attention was your recruitment process at The Spectator. That was quite interesting. Can you just please tell us about it?
Yes, I think every newspaper needs people from a diversity of backgrounds and insights. If you're covering the country, then you need people from all sorts of areas. Mm-hmm. So one of the great problems for any organization is how to do that. Now, the funny thing about journalism is that you don't really need a degree to see the world properly, to write well, to think originally. So how we recruit is we have a no CV policy. We say to people, don't tell us what your degree is and don't tell us anything about your education. We're going to give you, here are 15 challenges. We'd like you to do 7 or 8 of them. Typically, we get 200 entries. We choose the best 10. We take them into the office for a week or 2 weeks. And then we recruit the best person. So we know nothing about them at all. We don't know how old they are. We don't even know their name. We give them city names like London or Paris or Mexico or something. Yeah. So that means it's impossible to have any sort of discrimination, because quite often in the UK, you face sort of positive discrimination. So say you're white and from a rich background, then that shouldn't count against you anymore if you're black and from a poor background. So when we take these people in, we don't know their names or anything about them, then we find out where they're from. Now, I have found here that you do get diversity, but in ways you never expected to look at it. So when I first did this scheme, I expected a greater diversity of undergraduates, for example. What I found was you get people entering for internships who were in their late 20s. They were career changers. They'd ended up on the silver tram lines of their life going in one way. They weren't happy. but quite often there are not many opportunities to start completely afresh. So we had that. We had, I'll give you some examples. We had a 48-year-old mother of three who'd never really worked before, but her kids were old enough so she could have a career. So she started off as a journalist, her first proper job, at the age of 48. Now, that was, she's incredibly talented. She is now, she then went to work for the Sunday Times. She's now working as a television producer at the age of 52. She's only been a journalist for 4 years. So that's diversity. Experience never gets old. We've got a former store manager from Lidl, Cindy Yu. She's one of Britain's very few, in fact, might even be the only Chinese-British journalist. She's incredibly accomplished. She now does a podcast, Chinese Whispers, and she runs our broadcasting division. We had a Ukrainian refugee last year. She was an award-winning journalist in Kyiv, but she'd been displaced. And she was told when she came here that immigrants aren't employed as journalists. Now, looking around the British press, I'm afraid to say that's true. We are not very diverse. Immigrants occupy 20% of UK workers, but probably 0.2% of UK journalists. So Svetlana is now, you know, she's now a staffer with us. She's giving us insights you can never get from a British correspondent covering Ukraine because she understands the language, the culture, the social media. So in that, we have found that if you take the people from different perspectives and a passion for journalism, a desire to find out the truth, to go in uncomfortable areas, to tell stories, to share, to shine a light in darkness, those are all the journalistic virtues. And they are not confined to graduates from a certain background. There's a whole bunch of people who've got something to contribute.
Would you say that journalists in general are two alike? Same training, same experience, same background, same worldview?
It's human nature to have a sort of a bias. And the problem sometimes is if you think, okay, we're going to do diversity, you'll think, okay, let's get Oxford graduates of all sorts of ethnicities, you know. Yeah. And I do think that to guard against this, even asking to give a CV, then you're really narrowing it down to people whose life has gone a certain way. Your education so often is a snapshot of whether your life was going well or badly at the age of 17. Some people's life was a mess at 17. They picked themselves up later. But if you have got to go down the CV route, then you are going to narrow yourself. So I do think that that employers who use the CV methods and not just journalists, but people from all sorts, I think there is a bias towards the graduate factory. Now, of course, if you're going to be an accountant or a lawyer or a doctor, you need the professional qualifications. But for journalism, you don't. You need a passion for accuracy. And there are so many other creative industries, I think, that could draw from the talents of people who have perhaps, one of our guys who joined us recently was a civil servant for years, a former teacher. You know, people do not always at the age of 18 know what they want to do. Some people take the wrong decision. And say you make that decision at the age of 25. Look at Megyn Kelly, a very famous American journalist. She was a lawyer who decided to be a journalist at the age of 33. So you can make these segues. And I think not enough people do make these segues.
You also told me something about the podcast, Spectator podcast, that it has introduced the Spectator to a whole new demographic. Why is that, do you think?
Well, right now, when you see people on the underground, 15 years ago, they would all be reading a newspaper. Now, a whole bunch of them have got headphones on. We're listening to podcasts. Podcasts, with technology, has introduced whole new audiences to publications. People who would never think of picking up Svidea or thinking of picking up The Spectator can be introduced to our brand of journalism. Mm. Now, if you take the view that a publication is like a person, it's got its own character, its own identity, that character can be expressed across any medium you like, or television or podcasts or emails, anything, even TikTok, you know. Now, if you manage to express yourself across that, then you will come across an audience who will like The Spectator's way of thinking or SVT's way of thinking. And you can get people then interested who would never really pick up a magazine or a newspaper in a shop. And you can get lots of subscribers that way. Now, take the Times newspaper, for example. They've launched Times Radio recently. This is a pioneering endeavor where they've got a live radio station whose purpose is not to make money from adverts. The purpose is to introduce people who listen to podcasts and listen to radio to the Times newspaper. So it's an advertising tool. Now, that has proved very effective. The Times now makes serious money for the first time in living memory. So I do think, well, the great thing about podcasts is that you can reach out for people who are not in the habit of taking a daily newspaper or really reading the internet. But the other thing about podcasts is they're just so much fun, you know. I think
they are.
I mean, done properly, this should be a joy. We at The Spectator did podcasts for years before we could think of any real commercial purpose for them. So I think that if you love podcasts and that joy comes across to the people who are listening to your podcasts, then you can find, you know, people who would never otherwise come across you, and it's always great to have that conversation. I also find that when you meet as people come up to me, often who are Spectator fans, they're way more likely to say, I love your podcast, than to say, I love your magazine. Yeah. Now, part of me is a little bit sad about that because I'm a magazine editor. But then again, I think people have got a bond with podcasts. You get to know the people more. It's almost as if I think of the podcast I listen to, and there's a whole bunch of people who I've never met, who I almost regard as my friends because I've listened to them so much. I know how they react. I know what they get up to in their spare time because they say it. So I think podcasts allow a closer personal link, really, between the journalists and the listener than they do between the writer and the reader. And that can only be good for journalism. I think journalism is just so... You know, in this era of fake news, where you get your news from has never been more important. And I think that journalism has never been more important. And the more ways that we can think to reach out and communicate with people for whom they don't really think of The Spectator as a magazine. A whole bunch of people only ever think of it as an email or as a podcast or as a television show. And that is only a good thing, I think.
Mm. I think we have the same experience here at Svenska Dagbladet Ledare. Tove told me that she got so much feedback from the podcast. I listened to the pod and so on, far more than I've read in your paper, because there is, as you say, it's more personal relationship, and you are far more likely to comment on a podcast as well, I think, because there are a pretty close tie between the listeners and podcasters. And I hope you listeners know that I have the best job in the world, and that you can hear that as well. One question I forgot earlier. Opinion Corridor, if you tell the average British bloke that, does she or her he recognize it? Do you have an opinion corridor in Britain as well?
We would use different language, I think. We'd probably say that there are some things, if you say them, you're going to get cancelled. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a common refrain in most societies. In a healthy society, that is probably, if you're going to say something racist, you know, you will get, there will be a reaction, and quite right too. I think every society changes in how wide this opinion corridor is. In Britain, we have probably got the greatest variety of media of any country in the world. If you go into a newsagent in the UK, you can choose between, I don't know, between 10 or sometimes 15 newspapers. I can't think of any other country in the world where that is true. So every possible opinion is catered for. In America, it's not quite the same. The reason that Fox News came out of nowhere was because there was a significant chunk of American opinion that was not really catered for by the television. And so in Australia as well, the confines are a bit more narrow. Wherever the opinion corridor is narrower than public opinion, that creates an opportunity for two things. Either an opportunity for decent, respectable, truth-seeking journalists, or for cynical, rabble-rousing populist politicians. In my view, populism is always and everywhere a symptom of the failure of main political parties to respond to popular concerns. So everywhere when you look around Europe, you see a populist party. That is because somebody somewhere has not realized that the people have got some new concerns, usually about demographic change or the, and they haven't responded to that. I remember when I once interviewed Fredrik Reinfeldt after he became, after he lost his position as prime minister. Mm-hmm. And he was saying then that, you know, that when you're in office, there's always some new development that you miss because you're too busy running the country, running with government. and somebody spots new energy coming out from somewhere. I think he probably realizes now, but his open your hearts, open your wallets refrain was the exact opposite of what his party should have been saying at a time of great concern. I think that the funny thing about Sweden is that there is such incredible diversity. You know, it's so moving for us Swedophiles to arrive at Arlanda and see this "Welcome to my hometown" display. Is probably, to my mind, the most beautiful work of public art in Stockholm, because it shows you that this is a country famous by its people. Each of these guys individually is why the public, the outside world, has got a warm view of Sweden. It's not because of the lakes, it's not because of ABBA, it's because of the incredible diversity of people which you guys produce. And it's a sort of paradox, you know, how you can be so individualistic and so collective at the same time. A country so obedient that nobody ever crosses a red light, you know, even when there's no traffic at 2 a.m. And a country so rebellious that it votes, it defies lockdown. We haven't spoken about lockdown, no. But, you know, but that is one of the, you spoke about Sweden's image in the world, right? You guys had the self-confidence to stick with the science at a time where everybody else lost their head and panicked with devastating consequences for children's education. I noticed that Swedes never pack themselves in the back. You never pick up a paper here and think, you know what, we did not betray the kids, where every other country did. So, you know, I think so. I wouldn't say that the Sweden's opinion corridor, to me, it's a quirk. There are so many quirks to Sweden, so many crazy, you know, the way, you know, that the way that this, you can lose your job if you go eel fishing, etc. You know, these are quirks which we find endearing and mystifying. But there's also something which I regard as a Swedish mystery. I mean, in the same way that your language is very, it's easy to get to work out crudely, but to do it properly, it's so advanced. Like the Swedish word for juice and the Swedish word for candle,
use,
whatever. Okay. Some of us will never be able to get our heads around that. Yeah. So there are some little distinctions about Sweden, some little sacred mysteries, which even Scandophiles will never quite be able to work out. And the opinion corridor is one of them. But I'm going to, you know, keep on talking to the Swedes who are kind enough to give me their time to help me understand this. Because obviously, unless you guys work out what's happening, what is the source behind the gang crime, then it's going to continue. And you're going to end up with, I mean, somebody I was speaking to about this said, you know, Sweden, is the gang crime is bad, but this still is like, you know, 90% heaven, 10% hell, but you can avoid the hell. In other words, it's being sectioned off to a strub sata of society. Now, it is possible for societies to continue in that way, for to not really ask the questions, to think, well, you know, these guys are blowing themselves up, but they're not really blowing us up. But ultimately, that is not a settlement I think Sweden's going to go for. So I've got no doubt that this ingenious country, which is at the forefront of so many achievements, that I was in Uppsala the other day looking at these names on Uppsala University, you know, and there's Celsius up there. And, you know, is this, you know, and right now, one of the Swedish innovations is the thermos bomb. I think that's, you know, has been used here to an extent. Now, this, you know, I think Sweden will come to this inventive country will come to a solution about this. And we'll get there in the end. I think it's, you know, when I look around Sweden, actually, even though I'm here talking about gang crime, what strikes me is just how well you have integrated and continue to integrate new arrivals. Even people who arrived here in the last 5 to 10 years. It was, you know, I was watching Melfest this year. You know, we've got a Palestinian Swedish presenter. I haven't seen many Palestinian British television presenters. There's so many things which I think Sweden gets it wrong so seldom that it becomes almost spectacular.
But when we do get it wrong, we get it really wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and you struggle to talk about why you're getting it really wrong. So that's the funny thing about Sweden. In my view, you sometimes struggle to talk about your real successes. And I think there have been huge successes in integration, huge successes in public health policy, but also something going really wrong now. With gang crime, and this is something which you will be able to remedy. The police need to be given new mandates, the courts need to be given new powers. Yeah. You'll get there. But it will having to be adjust from being a sort of monocultural society to a multicultural society. And that, I think, is quite a big change.
Sweden, the country that continues to puzzle Fraser Nelson and the world. Thank you, Fraser Nelson, for joining me today.
Great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Och tack till er som har lyssnat också på Ledarredaktionen. Jag hoppas ni står ut med min något oslipade engelska. Ledarredaktionen, en podd från Svenska Dagbladet. Ni är varmt välkomna att höra av er till redaktionen med tankar och synpunkter på det vi precis nyss har hört. Ni kanske har reflektioner eller frågor på det som Fraser Nelson precis berättade. Men också om ni har idéer och förslag på vad vi ska ta upp i framtiden, gäster vi ska bjuda in och så vidare. Då är det bara att mejla till ledarsidan@svd.se. Dagens producent heter som alltid Jesper Sandström. Jag heter som alltid Andreas Eriksson och jag hoppas som alltid att vi hörs snart igen.